Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
Alisa Jaffe in for Ken Schramm this afternoon at 6 minutes after one. The drama continues in the Stephen Powell and Susan Powell and Joshua Powell case. The parents of Susan Powell now want access to police records. The police down in West Valley City, Utah, have these records that Ann Bremner wants to get her hands on. And Ann is on the line with us because you are representing Susan's parents. What is it that you're hoping to find within these records?
Well, a number of things. First is looking to find any more information on how Susan Cox Powell can be found. But we're also looking for information that would relate to an insurance dispute we have right now. Josh took $3.5 million worth of life insurance out on Susan and the boys, and there's now a dispute by the Powells against the Cox family for those proceeds. And there's information that there's more than one person being investigated, and if any of those are the claimants in this insurance case, we need to know that for the life insurance case.
So who might be able to get this insurance money now?
The Powells. Michael Powell, a brother, Alina Powell, a sister, and then Stephen Powell is a secondary beneficiary.
What did the Coxes say about that?
Well, they've just been to the ringer, as everybody knows. And so it's like every time they think that it can't get worse, it does. And that when they didn't even know about the bulk of this life insurance, but then learned about it through these insurance companies filing what are called interpleader federal actions, trying to have the courts sort out who should benefit from these proceeds. So they're simply, you know, they have me in there, you know, working for them, but they're just shell-shocked. But they definitely don't want to be in a dispute, any kind of dispute with the Powells. They don't want to have contact with the Powells. They don't want to, you know, think about the Powells, given what happened with Josh and also Stephen.
And, you know, a lot of times there aren't payouts in insurance cases when there's either a murder or a suicide. And in this case, there's both. So why would there even be a payout of $3.5 million?
That's a great question. And in this case, he took the insurance policies out in 2007, and there was kind of a grace period, if you will, during which those rules would apply, at least the suicide exclusion, and that was 2 years. And so that time has expired. On the homicide, it has to be a slayer statute, the slayer's dead. So, you know, if you're alleging that he was involved in Susan's disappearance. So unless there's somebody else, you know, that is a potential slayer, that would be an exclusion too.
Josh Powell killed himself and his two young sons in that fiery explosion back in February at their home in Graham, Washington. How long has it been since his wife has been missing?
Well, since December of 2009. And she's still considered a missing person, of course. And that's how Chuck and Judy see the case. And the West Valley City Police, of course, were investigating Josh Powell for her disappearance. And, of course, he's no longer with us at his own hands.
What could possibly be in the police records, Anne, that could maybe help you find Susan's body?
I think there'll be information about various searches, tips, you know, all kinds of information that maybe wasn't followed up on. And I say this because I have been contacted by a couple of witnesses that had very important information, and they went to West Valley City Police, and there was no follow-through. One was a witness, or there was an additional witness that overheard the boys saying something in a restaurant about their mom. The day after she went missing, there's another witness that had very specific information and potential physical evidence. And again, both these witnesses said there wasn't follow-through. So it's not just what's in there. It's what hasn't been followed up on as well.
What was said in the restaurant about the mom? Was this about the camping trip, or what was that?
It was that the kids started to say something about their mom being on a camping trip and wanting to talk to the waitress about their mom not being there. I'm paraphrasing. And then Josh Powell whisked them out of the restaurant. And so this witness went to the West Valley City Police, but she wasn't contacted again. And it's just my point is that if things aren't followed up on, you know, we need to know what those are so they can be.
How far are you going to go with the West Valley City Police? Because you need their cooperation, but it sounds like they may have messed up in a few areas.
Well, I think that, you know, understandably they're defensive, given the kind of scrutiny that's been placed on them by the national press, given that they had a lot of information that could have led to an arrest of Josh Powell, at least for Susan's disappearance, some kind of kidnapping. So the West Valley City Council is a group before whom I appeared last night, and they didn't seem very inclined to grant my request, but they'll make a decision in about 5 days. If they deny that.
Well, why didn't they seem inclined? Would they look at you like, ah, here comes the big slick city lawyer from Seattle?
One of them gave me a really hard time, and I finally said, you know, it sounds like you've made up your mind, but I hope you'll be fair. And then he said he would be fair. But
well, I got to admit, Ann, you know, seeing you walk into a room with how powerful and strong you are and determined, you know, it's going to make an impact in a small community in Utah. They're going to take notice, and they might be a little apprehensive.
Well, you're very nice. Those are kind words, but they...
It's funny.
The one that was really tough on me, I went and sat down, and I sat down right next to a whole group of Cub Scouts, and so they were there for the meetings. So they all kind of gave me a little thumbs up, or they looked kind of supportive anyway.
So you're in there trying to get information on a missing woman sitting next to the Cub Scouts in there. Have you talked to any of the police, the chief of police, or I don't know what kind of police setup they have there, but who have you talked to, detectives on the case?
Well, what we've done is we've made formal requests to the chief of police and the head of the sheriff's department, and then our request was denied by them, and then we went to the city manager, it was then denied by him, and then we went to the city council last night, and the city manager was in attendance, as was the mayor, and the city attorney and counsel for the police department. So to go to court, we would have to exhaust administrative remedies. That's what we've been in the process of doing. And they did deliberate some last night for about an hour on the issues, and then they retired, and they're going to look at some more documents. I told them, if you're saying this is an ongoing investigation and it would be compromised by giving records to me and my clients, you need to say, look at the records yourselves and see if it really is ongoing. And then second, you can basically disseminate to us with conditions saying you can't disseminate yourselves, which would protect you. And the city attorney agreed that could be done. So that's how we left it.
So saying that the case is still active in a way, and you don't want to jeopardize that if it truly is active.
Exactly. And so that's why we said we're happy to accept a conditional release, that we have complete confidentiality. So we want the investigation to go forward if it'll lead to finding Susan and have answers.
I haven't talked to Chuck and Judy Cox since the terrible week when their grandsons were killed. How are they doing? How are they recovering?
You know, I think they're such strong people, as you know, and they're such people of faith, and they have a strong support system. And so I'm always amazed at their resilience. They put one foot in front of the other every day, despite what they've been through. And they're hopeful that they'll get some answers here and in Utah that might lead to answers, of course, about Susan, but also to it's not happening again to other people. You know, there's a lot of things that went wrong, you know, all the way around. And they'd like to see ways to make it right in the future for other people.
Did they go back to the house where the boys died?
Well, they did back at the time.
Yeah, I know. I'm just wondering if that's where they feel like that's, you know, was the end for them.
Yeah. And actually Chuck went through and found a lot of family photos there and in the debris.
He did? Photos that survived the fire.
Yes, he did. Many, about three grocery bags full.
Wow, because that's right now, that's all they have left is a few photos and hope that they can finally find their daughter. And this sounds like you've got an uphill battle ahead. I know Ann Rule has written a book that's going to be coming out about this case, but sounds like the case isn't over, and Ann might have to do a little addendum after if you find out any information.
Absolutely. And I just think she's fabulous and she's such a great researcher, but there may be more at the end of this. I think I told you that Ann and I had dinner the night that the boys were murdered, and we'd had that plan for a while. We kind of texted each other and said, should we? And then I thought that the one person I'd like to be with right now is Ann Rule. I mean, to talk about how could this happen? What kind of person could do this? You know, all of those things.
She does do her homework. I've been on stories and covered the same cases as her, and she gets all the details. She's never let me down that way. Ann Bremner, thank you for being with us on Newsline PM.
You've heard what's happening. Now, find out what it means to you. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
It is 19 after 1. Elisa Jaffe in for Ken Schramm this afternoon. A federal weigh-man is in trouble today for allegedly threatening the President of the United States. Como 4's Tracy Vetter is on her way to the courthouse where this guy's going to have an appearance this afternoon. Tracy, why don't you break it down for us and tell us what this guy is exactly accused of doing? Because it was a threatening email at first, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's the case, Elisa. We're actually, I'll tell you, we're running around and using all of our resources to try and flesh out as much of this story as we possibly can. And we're finding out more and more as the hours go by throughout the day. But We still have, as you mentioned, we're on our way now to the federal courthouse where Anton Kolarie is scheduled to make an appearance. But we haven't got the charging, no charging complaint has been filed yet in federal court. So we don't have many of the details yet. The Secret Service that actually effected the arrest yesterday afternoon, along with the help of the Federal Way Police Department, are not speaking publicly about this case. They're going to wait and have the U.S. Attorney's Office release whatever information they're going to. We know that there were the allegations were that Anton Kolarie had emailed a threat against President Barack Obama directly to the FBI. What exactly is contained or was contained in that alleged threat, we don't know. We understand that when police and along with Secret Service agents approached the Federal Way apartment where Kolarie lives yesterday afternoon, he's reported to have met them at the door with a shotgun in his hand, although they were quickly able to disarm Kolarie and then bring him into custody. So that, of course, is going to be an issue, although we have been able to determine that he did have a concealed weapons permit. So we believe that those guns were legally, two guns were taken from the apartment, according to the information that we had from law enforcement. And both of those, we believe now, were legally owned by Kolarie.
So he had those weapons were confiscated, but you're saying he did have a concealed weapons permit. That was okay. But I heard there was a bomb, a unit going in to sweep the whole area, too, for explosives.
That's true. And we know that there were some materials taken away from the apartment, some tanks of something. Now, we don't know exactly what that was. It could be normal household items that somebody might regularly keep, but in the wrong hands can be turned into bombs or an explosive device of some kind. We just don't know. We've also been able to confirm that he had been in the Navy in the past and a number of other things. I did speak with his father, who is not in the state at this point in time, and have been able to find out a little bit more information about his background. But we're still trying to flesh all this together into a whole piece of information about who this person was and what may have prompted him, if in fact it's true, to send information that could be conceived as a threat against the President of the United States.
Come for us, Tracy Vetter, with us this afternoon. And I understand our news crews also spoke with his mother, who comes out and says her son made a mistake as a good education, a good boy, but he did a stupid thing.
That's true. And one of the things that she had had raised some information about or some concerns about to a neighbor was perhaps his state of mind, that he may have suffered some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder due to his service. I've confirmed with his father that there were some concerns about his mental well-being, but we have not been able to find out any more information as to whether he was ever diagnosed with anything or ever sought treatment for any type of mental disability.
What do we know about his service, and what did he do in the Navy?
As far as what we've been able to confirm, not very much, other than confirmation that he was, in fact, in the Navy. We understand he was discharged about 4 years ago. He may have been in there for 5 or 6 years, according to some information that he posted. He was
honorable discharge?
Don't have any information about that, but we have no reason to believe it was anything other than an honorable discharge. The Navy has not gotten back to me to officially tell us what his duties were. According to a post of his, he may have been done duty aboard a submarine, but what sort of position he maintained on that, we don't know for sure.
Yeah, because I read something that he'd gone on rambling about working with nuclear reactors and nuclear missiles, and so still a lot of stuff to sort out, it sounds like, and I know you'll be getting the charging documents when you head into the federal court this afternoon. Comfort's Tracy Vetter,
absolutely.
Thank you so much for being with us and giving us the latest on this Federal Way man who is accused of threatening the President of the United States of America.
Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
Alisa Jaffe in this afternoon for Ken Schramm. Remember when you folks said, you finish every single bite on your plate because there are kids starving in Africa? Well, Mama would be appalled at the findings of a new report put out by the Natural Resources Defense Council on how much food we as Americans waste. Dana Gunders is a scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council and the author of this new report. How much do we waste?
Well, just imagine going to the grocery store, buying 3 bags of groceries, dropping one in the parking lot, and not bothering to pick it up. It sounds ridiculous, right? But that's essentially what we're doing in the food system today. We're wasting up to 40% of all the food in this country that's going uneaten.
40% of our country's food supply is wasted?
I know. It's absurd. And it's costing us a tremendous amount of money, estimated at about $165 billion. That is all going towards food that never gets eaten.
What do you mean it doesn't get eaten? I know sometimes I'll buy things and then my kid will be over at his buddy's house and so I don't get around to making that certain meal so it goes bad. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, it sure is. The spoiled lettuce in our fridge, the potatoes on the breakfast platter that we're not eating because we're on a low-carb diet, the extra spaghetti when you cooked dinner for 2 people, all of that adds up.
I'm a big user of the leftovers. I incorporate them into new meals. I make my kid take them to school the next day. I take them to lunch. Is that a problem? Are there a lot of people who say poo-poo to the leftovers?
Yeah, good for you. They say only about half of the people out there take leftovers home from restaurants.
Really?
Yeah. Can you believe it? I mean, leftovers are my favorite.
Well, they don't take them home. Do they say why they don't take them home? They just don't care about them, or they just have a thing against leftovers?
I think some people do have a thing against leftovers. I think some people are on their way somewhere else and can't necessarily store them or don't want to. We each have our own individual food habits, and leftovers are part of that for some of us and not for others.
Well, this is outrageous. Dana Gunders is a scientist and the author of a new study about how Americans are wasting 40% of the country's food supply. You said this is a waste of about $165 billion. Let's break it down. Say there's a mom and dad and 2 kids in the house. How much are they wasting in food each year or per month?
Well, a family of 4 could be spending anywhere from $1,300 to $2,200 a year on food that they're not actually eating. And that's really just at the grocery level. That's not to say anything about all the restaurant food that we don't eat.
Well, and then let's look at the big picture. Let's look at, those who aren't composting and what this is doing to our landfills. What is uneaten food doing?
Well, food scraps actually make up the largest portion of product going into our landfills. Only 3% of all the food out there is composted today. And the rest of it is going into landfills where it produces almost a quarter of the nation's methane gas, which is one of the more powerful greenhouse gases.
Wait, how does this work?
Well, when the food gets to the landfill, it decomposes there and it off-gasses something called methane. And methane is a powerful contributor to global warming.
And then this is also eating up a lot of our fresh water consumed in our country, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. Agriculture itself in the U.S. takes up over half of our land area, and also an enormous amount, about 80% of our fresh water goes towards growing food in this country. And when you think that there's such a large amount that's going uneaten, you could say back of the envelope that about a quarter of all the fresh water in this country is going to growing food that's not getting eaten.
I have a thing where I'm a real sell-by date person. You got to use it by this date. And I looked at a salad that was in my refrigerator yesterday, and I think it expired on the 18th, but it still looked okay. But I've got this thing where I'm on the edge, on the fence, and I would probably more likely throw that out. Is that one of the problems? Do we need to really understand as Americans when our food goes bad?
It is one of the bigger problems that's going on with consumers. Those dates on food actually are not federally regulated, and they're not even meant to indicate the safety of the food. They are actually just manufacturer suggestions for peak quality, when that food is at its peak quality. It's almost always consumable, at least for a little while after that. And so I think You know, really giving things the sniff test and learning when food goes bad is one of the best steps we can take towards reducing our own individual food waste.
Oh, I hate the sniff test when I'd always hand my mother the milk and say, you smell it, smell it and tell me if it goes, if it's good. And she's like, why would I want to smell bad milk? That's just not fair. You know, one of the things is I was making a smoothie this morning and I was putting in some kale and there was a little bit of a brown edge on one and I still went ahead and I put it in the blender. Is that another issue? Are we a little worried about our scarred or imperfect produce?
We are, and I think our standards have gotten high to the point of insanity almost. You know, if the
a little brown on a lettuce isn't good, right?
Right, a little brown on a lettuce isn't good, but you know, our standards and the standards that are driving what the grocery stores are buying are quite high, and so. Just if it's not perfectly round and perfectly red or whatever color it's supposed to be, it's not even making it into the grocery stores these days. But that's just not how fruit grows on the tree. So it does lead to quite a bit of product not being eaten, at least by humans. A lot of it does go to animal feed.
Dana Gunders is a scientist with Natural Resources Defense Council, and you guys are environmental advocates. So what are you advocating Americans to do to change this waste of our food supply?
Well, we would just like to see the food system become more efficient all around. We think the government can help to accomplish that by setting some national targets for reduction in food waste and conducting a comprehensive study that will help us understand the problem better. We think businesses can help by looking at waste on their own premises and that's caused, you know, for their consumers.
We get a little worried about that here in Seattle, you know, because some people say, oh, wait a second, you're telling me I can't put food scraps in the garbage can anymore? I have to, you know, put them in the yard waste bin. And people don't necessarily all want that regulated, somebody snooping through to see if we're throwing right. away food.
Right. It's true. But, you know, I mean, it's going straight to the bottom line for businesses. If they're throwing out food that they, you know, could otherwise have saved money on, it's really a matter of efficiency for them.
And it could make a huge difference for us, because if this is really costing a family of four $2,200 in food each year, or 20 pounds of food per person per month, that's a lot of wasted meals that could go to help so many people. Dana Gunders, thank you for being with us on Newsline PM.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're going to look at the West Nile virus, because it is...
...cases in people has risen dramatically in recent weeks and indicate that we're in the midst of one of the largest West Nile virus outbreaks ever seen.
It's in a horrible situation, and the aerial sprayings are going to continue again tonight. We'll be looking at where these are having to focus on, how many people have lost their lives to this virus, and what do we need to be watching out for here in the Northwest.
This is Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
Good afternoon. Alisa Jaffe in for Ken Schramm, who's taken a few days off. It's 11 minutes before 2 o'clock. The numbers are pretty alarming with this West Nile virus, aren't they? Have you seen what's happening and how it's on track to become the worst year ever for the virus? ABC's Alex Stone joins us. And Alex, we are hearing about more than 1,100 infections and 41 deaths. Are they all focused in Texas right now?
Well, not all of them, Alisa. 41 people across the country have now died. 1,100 have been sickened. And we're told as of today from the Centers for Disease Control that the numbers may shoot up from here. We talked to Dr. Lyle Peterson from the Centers for Disease Control, and he says a lot of states are dealing with this right now.
Approximately 75% of the cases have been reported from five states: Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, South Dakota, and Oklahoma. And about half are from Texas.
But he says there are some other states that have had a case here, a case there. Over half who have gotten West Nile have had the infection spread to their brain. That makes it much more serious, and those are often the deadly cases. That aerial spraying to kill mosquitoes will continue, despite still some opposition in Texas. but they say they are going to do it. This is a judge in Texas who says he's approving it for again tonight and tomorrow.
Three planes are going to fly tonight, weather permitting. Our second application over the Phase 2 areas will be completed tomorrow night.
Now, unfortunately, nobody knows for sure if the aerial spraying is really having any impact on killing mosquitoes, but it is that last-ditch effort to save lives, and they're hoping that it is making an impact, but this really is an outbreak like the country hasn't seen before with West Nile.
And I know in our state we've had, you know, two mosquitoes test positive in two counties, but we don't have any cases of victims. It sounds like what it does to the person is just horrible. It begins with the fever and the headache and the body ache. But can you tell me more about how it's neuroinvasive, Alex?
Well, sure. I'm no doctor, but first of all, on the case of a couple that were found in Washington State, the belief is now among health professionals that West Nile is across the country, that Texas has it much worse than anybody else. But Texas also, and you heard him there mention Louisiana, Mississippi, those are prime breeding grounds for mosquitoes. It's very hot. It's very humid. A lot of standing water for them to breed in and around. So even though all the states may have it here or there, that the South really has it in mass, and that the mosquitoes have spread it amongst themselves and with birds. It's actually spread via birds. When the mosquitoes bite the birds, then they get infected with West Nile. But on the medical side of it, the way it's been described to me is it essentially turns into a meningitis-type disease and makes its way to the brain. But it is a nasty disease to get. Obviously, it's very, very fatal, and now 1,100 people have gotten it across the country, so very scary.
Yeah, because these symptoms we're hearing from headache to high fever, neck stiffness, you'll be disoriented and have tremors and convulsion and muscle weakness and could end up in a coma. There is no human vaccine, Alex, from what
no,
I understand?
No, there is nothing to fix the problem. You know, it's very much of like other diseases out there that are somewhat rare. And we heard about a case of hantavirus in Yosemite National Park last week, and that was a case much like this on the treatment side, that they can comfort the victims, but they don't really have any sort of fix for the victims. So, unfortunately, there is no way to cure anyone of the disease once they have it. They can try to make it better. They can try to comfort them. They can do little things here and there to bring down the swelling and the issues in the brain, but the deadly cases, unfortunately, they've had medical attention, but it's been too little too late.
It's been about 11 years since we had the worst year on record for it. Back in 2003, there were more than 9,800 cases of West Nile virus and 264 deaths. Any understanding of why we are seeing such a large outbreak of it this year?
Well, first of all, the CDC is saying they think this year could end up being worse, that so far in the timing of this is worse than any other year, that where we are right now in the calendar and the belief of how long it's going to continue on, that they have never seen it this bad this early on. So
even though we're hearing 41 deaths, and at that point it was 264 deaths, that they're thinking on track for an even worse year.
Yeah, they're looking at the numbers and saying at this rate, it looks like it could be quite a bit worse once all is said and done, once all the numbers are in. But this year, they point to just the situation, one, of the way the spread has gone, but two, the situation of mosquito breeding in the South and mainly that Gulf region, that the conditions have just been so prime for it that mosquitoes are very, very populous this year, and unfortunately that's meant more people getting bit and more people getting bit by mosquitoes that are infected.
Yeah, the mild winter and the hot summer, so we want to make sure your windows are and doors are bug tight and wear the repellent and don't give mosquitoes a second home. You don't want any of that standing water out in your yard. Alex Stone from ABC, thank you for being
with us.
You
got it. Have a good day.
You too.
Time to discuss, dissect, and debate the news. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
A teenager from New Jersey is going to collect more than $14 million to settle some claims over a brain injury from a metal Little League bat. It was back in 2006 when Stephen Domaluski was pitching in a Little League game when this line drive hit him right straight in the chest. That impact stopped the boy's heart. He was left brain damaged. And his family sued Louisville Slugger, the sports authority, and the Little League, saying, you know what, they didn't test the bat for safety properly. Some say baseballs hit by metal bats move faster than those hit by wooden bats. Domalewski is going to receive more than $14 million to settle the lawsuit, money his attorney said will ensure that he gets the care he needs for the rest of his life. And most metal bats are no longer allowed for younger little league players. Still ahead, what about those out-of-control fans at the baseball games, in the NFL, and at the soccer games? We're going to be talking in a half hour with Tom Glasgow about the new way that the NFL is considering cracking down on bad behavior. You might have to go to class.